Matthew chapter 18, and we're glad to have Brother Smitherman Mack, but of course our sympathies are with you in your loss, and we'll continue. I think the plan is to keep continuing, moving forward a chapter a week, and we'll adjust and adapt as needed as to who teaches it, but for the class's sake, we can continue to plan on that. So in Matthew chapter 18, before we get into the chapter, I wanted to ask a question and have something in the kind of in the back of our minds, even in the front of our minds, as we go through these different aspects or different sections of the chapter. There's somewhat of a theme, but it's more so a point of reference. What is the mission of Jesus, the Son of Man, on earth? How did he describe what he came to do? Okay, do the will of the Father. Why? Fulfill prophecy. Okay, yeah, Matthew's going to, he touches on that a lot. He came to seek and save the lost. So that's the aspect of his mission that I want us to keep in mind. These other things are true as well. And he's going to say that some of the translations, some of the manuscripts in verse 11 says that, for the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost. And I guess regardless of manuscript, we also see that Jesus saying that when he goes to Zacchaeus' house. So we know it is true whether or not it was originally in this particular context. And so we're going to talk about who's greatest in the kingdom and stumbling blocks and forgiveness and how to go to a brother in sin. And I want us to have this in our minds, in all these discussions. Jesus came to seek and save the lost. And so that is also our mission, is to be involved in his work. Obviously, we don't save in the way that he does, but we are involved in the lost being saved. So, verses 1 through 5, in contrast to that mission, we have the disciples who came to Jesus and said, "Who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" This seems to be a running theme with the disciples. At least three different occasions, they seem to be having an argument about this, or we're definitely having an argument about this. We have it here. They're on the road to Capernaum. It's also recorded in Mark 9 and Luke 9. Parallel accounts there. We see it again on the road to Jerusalem. In Mark chapter 10, verse 32, let's turn over there real quick. Mark 10, verse 32, they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was walking on ahead of them. And they were amazed, and those who followed were fearful. And again, he took the 12 aside and began to tell them what was going to happen to him, saying, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and the scribes, and they will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him and spit on him and scourge him and kill him, and 3 days later he will rise again." So when that's what Jesus is talking about, the natural next thing to ask is, can I be at your right hand or your left hand? I want to be great in this kingdom. Now, I don't know if the next comment came right after that or for some time after that, but regardless, Jesus is over here talking about, I'm going to die. And here are James and John, the two sons of Zebedee, in verse 35. They came up to Jesus saying, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" They said to him, "Grant that we may sit, one on your right and one on your left, in your glory." And we see that the other disciples hear this, and they're not having it because what? They also want to be there. It's not like, yeah, that's great. Love it for those guys. They're feeling jealous. They want that for themselves, or they at least don't want those guys above them. So that happens there. It happens on another occasion at the Last Supper in Luke chapter 22. So it seems like at least sometimes the disciples are getting into this at the most inappropriate times, but that's where their minds are focused. Who is greatest in the kingdom? Back in Matthew's account, we see Jesus brings a child to his side, or brings a child into their midst and says, here is the greatest in the kingdom. This is what you must be like. And from Luke's account, it says Jesus stood the child where? By his side. I like to imagine it's his right hand. Could have been his left. But those are positions of power, right? He did bring him into their midst, but he put him by his side. Maybe to emphasize a point, but Luke specifically calls that out. He stood him by his head, and it says, whoever receives this child, and so forth. In Mark's account, the way that this conversation develops is the disciples are having this conversation, the argument on the road to Capernaum. They get to the house, and Jesus says, what were y'all talking about? And they are silent because they knew what they were talking about. I presume that they were ashamed of it. And he goes on to, you know, help them to better understand, or at least show them a better understanding, a better way, and what it means to be great in the kingdom. So let's bring it to us, our day and time. What does it look like when we are seeking the right hand and the left hand in the kingdom? What kinds of things would we do, say? How would we act? We're not walking down the road with Jesus, but what might that look like for us? Go ahead, Keith.
Of little children, and every time that Jesus uses them as an example, I think of the little kids that are so forgiving when they're wrong, so loving with others, so willing to walk up to another kid around their age and include them or introduce themselves, so much in fellowship. So that's what I see.
Okay, yeah, great. Kids can be so infuriated with each other. And 2 minutes later, they're back to being best friends. It's not that they don't get mad. It's that they just move on because they love each other. All right, so that's what true greatness looks like. Not to take away from that, I'm going for what the disciples thought greatness was. But go ahead, Angel. Either way.
Okay, they're coming.
Either way.
To talk about what Keith said, you know, kids, they don't think about what culture's supposed to be like or what color that other person is or how much money they have or if they have nicer clothes. None of that means anything to a five-year-old as long as somebody will play with them. You know, he takes people, kids take people for what they see. They don't sit there and try to read into it or wonder if they're, you know, going to hurt them later. They just go forward in innocence.
Yeah, innocence, that's good. Honesty, humility, innocence is a good, they're just open to it, except Daniel.
I think of, for example, a song leader who wants to be the most popular song leader. Or someone who searches the scriptures in order to be able to say that they found something new, not because they want to know or find the truth, they want to be able to say, look what I found.
All right, so we got being the most popular. It might be song leader, might be preacher in the brotherhood, might be fill-in preacher in a local brotherhood, or looking for some kind of ego boost on. I found something that nobody's seen before. Okay. Other thoughts along those lines or in that area?
Hierarchy, status.
Okay. Status, hierarchy.
Which they got from the world, right? All the way back to the Old Testament, we said you don't need a king. Everybody else has a king, right? It's the same. We want this, the ladder, climbing the ladder. And yes. Jesus is saying there's a ladder. We're all the same.
Like that worldly viewpoint of it's all about me and my position and just bringing it into the kingdom. So I've got some kind of categoricals, and any more, welcome to chime in. kind of categorical things that might happen. Gaining a following, public prominence. In Acts 20, verse 30, Paul is talking to the Ephesian elders and saying, wolves will come in from the outside and even from among yourselves, whether he's saying the elders or the Ephesians at large, from among you there will rise up people who will speak perverted things to draw the disciples away after themselves. So there can be this power play. And I want prominence, I want position, I want a following. Sometimes it's by force. Rather than influence, it's more coercion. Control, power. We see that with Diotrephes in 3 John 1. He rejected God, God's appointed authorities. He refused to welcome brethren, and he stopped those who wanted to welcome them in and put them out of the church. So he liked the power, but he was aggressive and domineering about it, and he wanted to be that way. In 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 2 through 4, Peter is exhorting the elders not to... let's turn over there so I don't paraphrase it and miss the power there. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 2. He says, shepherd the flock of God among you, exercising oversight, not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will of God, not for sordid gain, but with eagerness. So, not in it for yourself to find ways to enrich yourself, nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. And let's just kind of put a little pin in that end there, which is, you can rule in such a way that you bring things for yourself, but if you don't, if you lead humbly and you lead with service, the chief shepherd will give you an unfading crown of glory. We can seek the right and left hand in the kingdom by willfulness. Maybe we're not trying to have everybody follow us, but as long as I've got my way, then we're okay. The younger are reminded to be subject to the elders in 1 Peter 5:5. And all are to be clothed with humility toward one another in the same verse. And then it says, God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. So again, we have, when someone humbles themselves, God gives a crown of glory. God gives grace. And so seeking our own really reflects incredible lack of faith in God. It says that me, by my power and my influence and whatever I can wield, I can gain more for myself than God can give me. Because he says, humble yourself and I will give you glory. I will give you a crown of glory and grace, and he will lift you up. So I can, it's a claim, it's a belief that I can lift myself higher than God can lift me. We consciously think that, probably not, but that is borne out in our actions when we seek power, prestige, position for ourselves. So these are all kind of bold ways, assertive ways of seeking the right and the left hand. But there can also be more of a shadow government, a influencing, trying to get our way from the shadows and the undertones, undercurrents. In James chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, he says, what is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? So quarrels and conflicts, because we want stuff for ourselves. You lust and do not have, so you commit murder. You are envious and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures. So when we're seeking the right and left hand because of our own desires and our own pleasures and not so that we can serve others better, then we're not going to receive what we're looking for. causing strife, that doesn't have to be from the pulpit big and loud. In fact, it's really insidious, probably more effective when it's insidious. Complaining when things aren't the way we want them. In Jude 1, verse 16, he talks about grumblers who find fault, following their own lusts, speaking arrogantly, flattering people to gain advantage. In verse 15, these will be judged, convicted as ungodly for their ungodly deeds done in an ungodly way, speaking harsh things against God as ungodly sinners. I find that verse just kind of humorous in how many times it says ungodly. It just everything is, but what is he talking about? Grumblers, complainers, finding fault, seeking their own, but whispering to do it. Gossiping and slandering, kind of along that line, Romans 1, 29 through 30. So sometimes it's not just in everybody's face, but we can be seeking our own quietly and just as destructive a way. All right, still in this section, he talks about receiving a little child. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 18 and verse 5. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. What does that mean, to receive a child in his name? How would you describe it?
Is that like when you have brethren and how you receive them, and it's kind of like what Keith, I think, was getting at. You receive them in full fellowship. There's not judgment. There's encouragement. There's exhortation. All the things that we want to do or should want to do for others, just as we would, you know, Christ is standing before us and we appreciate who he is. How do we treat him? Well, we should love. We should appreciate. We should cherish that relationship. We want to spend time with that Christian. Something like that, maybe.
Yeah, I suspect that's included in there. Open arms welcome, right? They're part of the fellowship. You are fellow heirs of the grace of life. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. In Mark chapter 9, verse 37, he also records Jesus as saying, "He who receives me does not receive me, but him who sent me." When you receive someone else, when you receive someone who comes in someone else's name, what is that person called in government? An ambassador. He may be saying to us, children are ambassadors for me. They are showing you who I am. And so when you receive a child in Jesus' name, You're receiving Jesus himself. And when you receive Jesus, you're receiving the Father. You're welcoming them in. This child is coming to you, or a person with a childlike spirit, humble. They're a servant of all. They're the last of all. So we should receive them in that spirit, recognize that they are coming in the spirit of Jesus. And we shouldn't say, oh, here's somebody who's humble and a servant. What can I get out of this situation? I can walk all over them, get them to do whatever I want because they're coming in the spirit of a child rather than, oh, this person's coming in the spirit of Christ. I should recognize that and honor that in my relationship with him. Anna.
The translation of the NIV, it says, whoever takes the lowly position of this child is the greatest in the kingdom.
Okay, so receive that, like, attitude, that mindset into themselves and takes that. Okay, that's interesting. And that's what we'll do. If we recognize the value in that mindset, then we will adopt it for ourselves. Brother, do you like?
Come as a little child, and then humbles himself as this little child, and then receives one little child.
Times in the last couple years where the kids and I will be at a place and there's a child that's lost. And when we figure out, okay, this child's lost, it's usually the older kids are like, well, mom, he can't find his parents. My priority is this child's my child until we find the parents. Like, I'm there to protect and love. And the opposite of you is, okay, not my child, not my problem. But I feel like that's, there's a parallel in what Jesus is saying, like, like such a precious soul, and like, they're worth it, you know?
Okay. He's about to switch gears a little bit, but not separate discussion. Talk about some other ways that we can treat children, and this connects here. That it's one thing to welcome a child in, but what's the worst that we could do is to put a stumbling block, cause them harm, cause them to come to harm. And so let's keep reading here in verse 6. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it would be better for him to have a heavy millstone hung around his neck and to be drowned in the depth of the sea. One of these little ones who believe in me. So he may be expanding beyond just a physical young person to anyone who is young, innocent in their faith, and tender, vulnerable, that when you cause that person to stumble, young or old, it's very serious. He gets very graphic in this section about how serious he's taking these things. So woe to the one who presents the stumbling block, verse 7. Woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks, for it is inevitable that stumbling blocks come. But woe to that man through whom the stumbling block comes. Is a stumbling block necessarily sin in and of itself? Like, if I'm not sinning, it's impossible for me to create stumbling blocks. Is that true? All right. In Romans and 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 8 through 13, and again in Romans chapter 14, verses 13 through 15, we see that our liberties can be a stumbling block. I'm going to do my thing because God says I can. I don't care what happens to you. That's putting a stumbling block in front of us. It can be a stumbling block to someone else. And Jesus condemns that very significantly with a very stern warning about having a heavy millstone hung around your neck. You're going to be better off if that happens to you before you cause a stumbling block to someone else. Is there a hand over here? Okay. And moving on to verses 8 through 9. If your hand or your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. It is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than to have two hands or two feet and be cast into the eternal fire. If your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out and throw it from you. It is better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be cast into the fiery hell. So it's not just others, it's for us as well, that we should be guarding our own faith, our own consciences, our own lives, and we should take drastic measures to do this. Does he literally mean plucking out your eye and cutting off your hand? I don't think he's trying to be specific. I believe this is included. If that's what it takes, you do it. Is that likely to stop you from sinning? Probably not. I think he's being more than literal, or maybe less than literal. If the measure is more drastic than this, you should take it because of the consequences. What are some things that we would give up before? No. That we would give up our sight, our hand, our ability to use our hands and our feet before we would give them up. Does that make sense? What's more precious than that to us in our lives? Okay. Depends on how good your eyesight is, right? Family? Would you give up your eye if it saved your family in some strange scenario? Would you sacrifice your hand, risk your hand to rescue your child from a dangerous situation? Absolutely, without a second thought. So there are things, we already recognize there is greater value than some of our physical capabilities. Jesus is highlighting how important it is for our spiritual lives and our eternal situation. I find it interesting that he doesn't just say, cut it off or pluck it out. What does he add to that? Cast it from you. It sounds unnecessary at that point, but it's not. I would just, maybe it's just emphasizing, I'm not going to take my eye out as the way that he described it and stick it in my pocket for later. It's like, I don't want it anymore. I'm going to throw it away. I think about cutting my hand off and then trying to throw it away left-handed. I'm right-handed. But it's just, he's going, okay, cut it off and throw it away, as if cutting it off wasn't significant enough. Just very serious, causing others to stumble or creating situations, remaining in situations where we are led to stumble. In verse 10, he says, see that you do not despise one of these little ones. So, tying it back to the earlier discussion, for I say to you that there are angels in heaven continually see the face of my Father who is in heaven. I don't have much to say about that. Jesus didn't say much about that. But he said it, and it's significant that these little ones who believe in Jesus have angels in heaven who see the face of the Father. And what we know about angels, that ought to intimidate us, or ought to cause us to wake up and pay attention, as if God's judgment wasn't enough. He's got beings dedicated to the care of the people that he loves, those who believe in him.
If you mess with one of them, he's going to notice. He has someone dedicated, a being, to this.
Yeah. Are they advocating? Are they paying attention? Hey, you see what's going on? Like, as though he needed that, but he hasn't. Like, he works in a lot of different ways. But it's just throughout the section, he's just adding one more reason when even the basic reasons should be enough that... souls are so valuable, which brings us back to the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost.
Tim. It's made me think, especially with verse 6, how the despicableness of taking advantage or ruining, tainting something that's pure. You go to prison, I've never been there, but... from what I hear. What sets off people in prison? When do they start getting violent? When a child is abused. When somebody comes in that took advantage of someone who is innocent, even as vile as some people may be, even that crosses the line. And we talk about taking advantage and ruining someone whose heart is ready to obey and turning them away. Or our own self, how vile we are. Get rid of that hand. It's vile. Whatever you got to do, because that's how despicable disobedience and turning yourself even away from God is. Get out of there. It's just there's just something there that is so powerful in that anything that turns away an innocent thing that could go towards God, it's got to get out of here.
It's interesting to look at it from the perspective of God loves us just like he loves those children. And he doesn't want anybody tainting us. Doesn't want other people tainting us, and he doesn't want us doing it either. So, as odd as it might sound, it's understandable that he would be mad at us for taking what he purified and soiling it. All right, let's move on to verses 12 through 14. Again, continuing with this idea, Jesus came to save that which was lost. What do you think? If any man has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go and search for the one that is straying? If it turns out that he finds it, truly I say to you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 which have not gone astray. So, It is not the will of your Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones perish. So this is a little lamb that wandered off, right? What do we know about the sheep? Nothing. I picture it as a lamb, but it could have been an old ornery ram or a ewe. It wandered off, and it's just as precious. It's just as valued by the shepherd. And so let's keep that in mind. This one person, they wandered off. We didn't really like them anyway. They weren't that pleasant. It's okay. But this other person, they were my friend. They were someone pleasant to be around. That's the sheep we should go after. It's not how it is. That's not what he says. They're in the flock, and they left. Go get them. So let's keep that in mind, that it's not just the cute little lambs that wander off. It could be something old and ornery. It could be in the prime of life, just wherever, physically, spiritually, you know, socially. He went after it, and he rejoiced when he found it.
Sheep are typically dumb. They don't really understand what they're doing and where they're going. They can be taken out by almost any type of predator. They can get themselves stuck in the brush. They can fall off cliffs. All kinds of things can happen to them. They're a very frustrating thing for a shepherd to see after, because they can get sick, they can get hurt, stranded, and they will just roam off. They'll see something and they'll just go for it. Don't give any thought to it. We are so much like them. It is scary when you have time to spend with them. But yet our Father continually throughout Scripture compares us to sheep, which should be humbling to us. Sometimes you want to just kill them because they're dumb. And you see that in the Old Testament, the Jews especially. But you see it in the New Testament too. Yet God loves each and every person he has ever given the breath of life on this earth. And I think that's what he's talking about here. No matter how dumb we are for our own care and our own well-being, how honoring we may be, as you pointed it out, and how much we may have deserved what was going to happen to us when we leave the flock, he still rejoices, and we know the angels rejoice in heaven when one returns to the flock. So I think we need to realize two things. One, we're just as bad as sheep. And how they do the shepherd, or how they have no disregard for their own well-being and the problems they cause. But at the same time, we need to realize how precious each and every one of us are, and how much our God loves us. No matter what we do, what we have done, he always wants us to come and obey him. And how dare we not want to go get one of the sheep when we see it roaming off and help it come back, help that person come back. We need to be diligent about that, no matter whose child it is, what they did to me last week or last year or 10 years ago. That should never enter our mind. We should have that love that we see from our Father, the great shepherd, every time.
He spoke as one having authority. Someone who knows about sheep more than I do. And that's very good insight and very good application. In verses 15 through 17, speaking of going and finding the sheep, if your brother sins, go and show him his fault in private. If he listens to you, you have won your brother. But if he does not listen to you, take one or two more with you, so that by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every fact may be confirmed. If he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. And if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. If your brother sins against you, go. Win your brother. That's a tough command. Against you is not in every translation, but it is in some. He's saying, someone has wronged you. It is your responsibility to go. The sheep kicked you on the way out. Go get it. Because you're the one that knows about it. You saw it leave. And your goal is to win your brother. Can you think of someone else who was wronged and went out of their way to go and reconcile the offenders to themselves?
My first thought was David and
Absalom. Okay, David's good. Give me an example. Hint. God did. God sent his son, and we're those sheep. And he was the one most offended, most wronged, and yet he went to reconcile us. So like JR said, who are we to do anything but that? There's a lot of discussion at times about whether we have to follow this pattern. Does this pattern apply in this situation or that situation? And there's probably some specifics that we could dig into and try to figure that out. There are certainly other passages that come into play on how we approach a situation where someone has sinned. Is their sin public or not? Have they sinned against us or not? Well, how much do we know about the situation? 3 John 1:10, John wrote to Gaius about Diotrephes and how he, John, would handle the situation if he came. Galatians 2:14, Paul confronted Peter publicly because of something he did. Paul names names in several letters. He withholds names in several letters. So there were times when he would call names out and sometimes that he wouldn't. Sometimes he would just jump right to step three, you know, tell it to the church kind of approach. When we dive into those discussions, I do wonder why. Especially if we're trying to define it very narrowly and say, I didn't have to do this. I didn't have to go to someone privately. Fair. Maybe you didn't. Maybe we have examples of people not doing that. But why are you so concerned about making sure that you didn't have to? Could it be, I'm not saying it is, but could it be sometimes we just don't want to? And so we're looking for a way that we don't have to go have that difficult conversation. Or maybe we don't want the good outcome. So we want to check the boxes. I did my right thing and it didn't work out. Oh, too bad. Because we don't care about the person's soul. If we find ourselves digging into those specifics and trying to justify what we want to do, that we need to really check our attitudes and thoughts towards that. We've got a couple minutes left. Has anyone, by show of hands, and you don't have to raise your hands, just if you want to participate, has anyone ever gone to someone privately over something that they was done to them or that you saw? Has anyone ever had someone come to them in that private manner to address something? I'm raising my hand for both. Anyone who's willing to share, how did that go? Good, bad? What was your experience?
Honestly, every time I've ever had to do that, it's worked out great. And I'm always like, why was I so worried about that? I should have just followed what the Lord, you know, the pattern that he gave me. And personally, it's worked out great for me every time.
Did your relationship with those people change?
I don't really think so. If anything, I think maybe it got better.
There's a someone I know about as a story that really impressed me, and they're in here. They'll recognize it probably. Where someone thought they were teaching something that wasn't from the scriptures, wasn't scriptural. And they were concerned, but they came to them and said, I need to talk to you about this thing I heard you're teaching. And I said, you may not be my friend anymore after this, for me thinking that you would teach this. And their response was, you are my best friend because you came and asked me about it. And I was so impressed by that. And I wanted to have that attitude as well. If someone comes to me, whether they're right or wrong, made good assumptions or bad, agreed or, you know, at the end of it, if we agreed or not, we ought to appreciate how difficult it is to go to someone and tell them they're wrong, or how difficult it ought to be, and recognize that people have risked a lot, probably more nervous about it than you, to come to you and say what they felt needed to be said. So let's be gracious with each other. Let's be patient with each other. And by all means, let's not go gossip about people publicly, privately, in secret, whatever. And not make it about, oh, here's a process. I've got to check boxes so I can get to withdrawing from them. That's absolutely not what's going on here, what Jesus is talking about. This is the process of saving your brother. And if we keep that in mind, I think the rest of it will take care of it itself. That's it for our time. Go on to talk about forgiveness, how many times we ought to forgive each other, and just everything in here is so tied to seeking and saving the lost. If we keep that in mind, I think we'll be able to navigate a lot of these situations well. Thank you.